So this is the third evening of four evenings speaking of on the topic of the five spiritual powers, which are sometimes called the five faculties or sometimes the five precious jewels. Tonight my goal is to do a fairly quick review or summary for those who weren't here previously, say a few more things about faith, talk about the balancing of concentration and energy, and end up with time for if you have questions and the announcements. So that's quite a challenge, but we'll see if I can do it. Five spiritual faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Sometimes faith, we can use the word conviction or even commitment. Energy, we can also talk about vigor or persistence or even the energy of interest. Mindfulness is the heart of this group. Concentration, we could also say focus or even intention, the energy of intention. Wisdom, we could also say discernment. So those are the five. I've been emphasizing looking to our own practice experience and our own life experience in addition to any sort of intellectual understanding we have or reading and so forth, listening, there are some good talks, particularly I think Rodney has some on your website and Gil Fronsdale. On these five and things we can read, but taking it as an experiment to feel these energies in our practice and in our daily life so we get a sense of the flavor. What is the experience of either any of these five? And then I'll once again read my favorite paragraph because it gives a nice summary of how these work together and in balance. And that's a paragraph Joseph Goldstein wrote long ago in Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. The five spiritual faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are our greatest friends and allies on this journey of understanding. These qualities are most powerful when they are in balance. Faith needs to be balanced with wisdom so that faith is not blind and wisdom is not shallow or hypocritical. When wisdom outstrips faith, we can develop a pattern where we know something and even know it deeply from our own experience and yet do not live it. Faith brings the quality of commitment to our understanding. Energy needs to be balanced with concentration. Effort will bring lucidity, clarity, and energy to the mind, which concentration balances with calmness and depth. An unbalanced effort makes us restless and scattered, and too much concentration that is not energized comes close to torpor and sleep. Mindfulness is the factor that balances all these and is therefore always beneficial. And next week we will do a celebration of mindfulness as the core in this list of five powers. So we've been given pairs then here. Faith balanced with wisdom, energy balanced with concentration, and then the heart is mindfulness. A couple of things that I wanted to mention about experiencing these, and maybe also particularly faith, but I had one memory. You may know of a way of working with painting there was a book and workshops in California called The Painting Experience. Anna Douglas is a Dharma teacher who does workshops with this as well. And it's a process whereby it's sort of a stream of painting consciousness. You don't bring in your mind at all, the facilitators, they see you pause at all for a moment of thinking. They'll just encourage you to just paint, just keep painting, just keep painting. It's quite an amazing way of working. So I did some of those in California years ago, and one friend of mine mentioned once, a lot of the Vipassana folks from in Marin County were attending these trainings, and my friend Deb said that one time Jacqueline, who is one of the founders of this method, asked a question to her about something to do with the painting that she was working with, something about how it felt. And Deb, who was a Vipassana meditator, closed her eyes immediately and then, you know, looked inside and said something. And Jacqueline laughed and said, "What I love about you Vipassana meditators is when you're asked a question about your experience, you always close your eyes." And I thought, yes, that we're really trained to look within, and quite literally, you know, even in this painting workshop, which is a visual activity, but it emphasized that Deb wasn't going to think where, you know, the eyes will go in one direction or the other, depending on whether it's conceptual thinking or right brain thinking. But she just closed them because she was feeling into her experience in order to respond. And I think perhaps particularly with something like faith, we can have a lot of conceptual notions about it. We can have a lot of conceptual reactions to it. We can have ideas and opinions. But to feel it, if we want to feel it, we want to go within and kind of move around in there a little bit. Because, as we mentioned before, faith is also an action. It's an activity. Just interesting. It's not something we have. It's something we actually do. But to realize that, we have to look inside, feel around, and see what that feels like, how it happens when we engage in a moment of faith. And Sharon Salzberg, who wrote this wonderful book that I've recommended to you on faith, which also interweaves that with her personal spiritual journey and many, many stories. She's had a lot of adventures on the path, and it's quite beautifully written, so I do recommend it. But she mentions traditionally, it's a traditional, all of what she says in there actually outlines the traditional teachings on faith, but she does it in such a wonderful, skillful way, interweaving with her own experience, that instead of just getting it as a teaching, you actually really can get the flavor of the reality of the journey, which is quite good. So one aspect that she mentioned is how this experience of faith is different from and not only different but helps us out of is our refuge from both hope and fear, but a certain kind of hope that is called technically fixated hope, which actually we're hoping, but there's a fear because we have conditions. We have a specific agenda of which we're hoping for. So in situations where there may be fear and anxiety, then we're also a little bit careening back and forth from fear to a certain hope that is fixated, that has a particular agenda. And which, because there is such a likelihood of our particular agendas not being met, that bounces us right back into fear. So we kind of dance back and forth between those two. But there's another way. It's not denying hope so that we all just throw up our hands and become hopeless, but another way of experience, which I would actually call, she doesn't, but I would call it faithful hope. Or maybe that's faith would include that positive kind of hope, which is quite open. It's very positive, confident. This kind of a conviction, but it's also quite open, so that we don't have a particular agenda that must arise, and yet we're still able to transcend fear with this activity of faith. So she says faith, in contrast, contrasting it to fixated hope and fear, reminds us of the ever-changing flow of life with all its movement and possibilities. Faith is the capacity of the heart that allows us to draw close to the present and find there the underlying thread connecting this moment's experience to the fabric of all life. It opens us to a bigger sense of who we are and what we are capable of doing. So what I want to do is convey how you could actually experience that, what was just said, in your own practice and in your own life, and how you probably have. You'll remember this. When we are caught in some sort of difficulty or distress, either in our own life, I've experienced this time and time again, or I've also experienced it with feedback from students in the correspondence course and people in groups, where they're asking me, or I am asking me, if it's my own experience, what I need to do in this moment of difficulty or distress. And as a Dharma practitioner, a Dharma teacher, the answer always, I access Dharma, and particularly replying to students and myself, I feel I need to get something really very, very specific to practice. So it can be just do the practice. For example, be mindful. So if there's some distress, then we remind ourselves, be mindful of the distress. The emotion itself, its unpleasantness, the body sensation, its unpleasantness, or just the gigantic category, restlessness, fear, worry. And that's the moment with its faith in the practice to actually do it. Do the momentary technique. I mean, we have that kind of a generic sense, oh yes, I understand the practice and I understand this and I'm sort of practicing in my life or I'm very much practicing daily. But in that actual moment of difficulty and distress, we're caught in identifying with the difficulty and distress. We're in that story as well we might be. Life is rough, you know? So then, rather than often, we have a kind of a little subtext going on of judgment of ourselves that somehow, if we were doing our practice right, we wouldn't be experiencing this distress. But that's not true at all. Life happens continuously to all of us. So the key, our faith, expresses itself in actually the movement where, okay, I know this. Ah, mindfulness. All right. Now, what is mindfulness right now? Mindfulness of, say, disappointment. Mindfulness of really unpleasant emotional feeling. Then mindfulness of body, mindfulness of breath, mindfulness. We track ourselves back to draw close to the present moment. And then the feedback that I get when I remind people to do that is that it works. The feedback I get from myself when I remind myself to do it is, wow, this stuff actually works. But that's the moment where we have to energize, so that I say faith is an action. We actually have to act on what we know. We know that these techniques work. Okay, maybe that one doesn't work. Maybe loving kindness, particularly if we're caught in some sort of a tremendous experience of guilt or shame or self-blame. And then we think, oh, well, loving kindness would help. But do we actually do it in a moment? Do we sit down or stand up or run to the restroom if we're at work and do a couple of minutes of loving kindness for ourselves? To actually just simply do it. Not know that it can be done, not know that it should be done, or not have the judgment, if I did more loving kindness, I wouldn't be feeling this. You know? No, what's happening is happening. No blame, no harm, no foul. What's happening is happening. So then moving to the practice itself and see if it helps even a little bit. Or sometimes some of you might know particularly from Pema Chodron's work, in the Tibetan tradition there's a practice of Tonglen, which has many, many different techniques. But one of the simplest and yet I find the most effective is when we're in distress, having a moment of understanding, which is why I put a particular kind of, in our metta tonight, I interjected a little bit of a different technique. I said, think of all the people right now that are having the same difficulty and connect our hearts with them, and then wish us all comfort, wish us all support, wish us all healing and loving kindness. And there's something quite powerful about that. Suddenly, actually, palpably, you're in a particular sangha, and it's a sangha of a group that is struggling just like you are, and so you're not alone. And so that gesture of, you know, we call it a technique, but it's actually a real event, an action that we take, that in faith we open our hearts to others. In a way, we're sharing our pain and we're sharing our wish that we all would be comforted, would be healed, would be supported, would be surrounded with kindness. And in that moment, something shifts. And that also is the flavor of the action, an action that is the action of faith. So play with that. Experiment with that. Get the flavor of that. We also mentioned last week, I believe very quickly, that there are three kinds of faith. Bright faith, which is the kind of the beginning of things, the falling in love faith, falling in love with a practice, a tradition, a teaching, whatever it is. But here with our spiritual practice, very exciting, very wonderful, very twinkly time, very fragile. So be good to yourself, and also if you're a little bit further along, when others present that bright faith, know that it's fragile in people. Don't stomp on it from a place of authority. Just, you know, celebrate with people who have that. The downside is the negative, but the downside form of that is blind faith. If we don't graduate from bright faith to starting to actually explore, we can go into blind faith. But the positive direction, bright faith evolves into verified faith. We start asking questions, we start exploring, we start validating our experience, and so forth. So there's a moving of through experience, experimentation, strengthening, finding teachings. And what happens there, bright faith is more of faith outside. Verified faith starts to be inward, starts to belong to us. And a lot of theistic and revealed traditions don't necessarily support that too much. Some do. But that's a more inward faith in our own ability to walk our spiritual path. It then deepens and deepens to something called enduring faith, abiding faith, and then unwavering faith, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. It really is part of the golden aspect of this path and this journey. And one can get to the point where nothing will shake your commitment and your confidence and your faith in the path. Get to the point where you're very, very grateful that you know whatever comes up, you have your path, you have the Dharma, you can count on it. And in that, I love a quote from Suzuki Roshi. Even if the sun were to rise in the west, the bodhisattva has only one way. That's a statement of enduring faith. Beautiful experience to have and conviction to have. Returning to our journey, balancing faith with wisdom. Another thing that we can look at with faith is, it's very, in the teachings, particularly in the Abhidhamma, they're talking about the various states of mind and so forth and what causes what. And oddly enough, the proximate cause, the cause that's going to result in faith, is suffering. Isn't that interesting? That's a little weird. But you can play around with this also to create a few experiments, practical experience, to see if this is true. So once again, as I said earlier, when we have some sort of difficulty or distress, and at this stage of experimenting, minor suffering would be best. So looking at experience of minor suffering, and then as I mentioned earlier, taking particular action related to Dharma practice in terms of, okay, apply more mindfulness to this, or be mindful of this in a certain way. Instead of being caught in the story, be mindful that this is disappointment, and how does it feel? Or be mindful that this is anger, aversion, and how does it feel in the body? Or choosing to take the action, as I mentioned, with loving kindness and so forth, or even Tonglen kind of practice. And then, or in ordinary life, some sort of action, or maybe the action, particularly with anger, is often letting it be, letting it go, not acting, not reacting. And then see that experience, see if you experience a change. Consider that that experience, that action that you took, has the quality of being an act of faith, or is a part of your faith in the path, in the practice, in the Dharma, your faith in your own capacity to change your experience, to create new activities, new reactions or non-reactions and so forth. So if that's faith. And then finally, reflect on having seen the efficacy of these certain techniques, or many of you are probably remembering this in practice situations, ask, see how difficult it would be to be convinced of the efficacy of these techniques if you had taken the action without having experienced suffering versus applying the action to suffering. So what this means is that sometimes when people are in practice, maybe it's beginners, but this can also happen to people in any part of the path, where there's a sense of, I'm doing this practice and I'm just bored, you know. So what? You know, rising, falling, sitting, touching, and then the mind wanders and I let go of it and I come back to body sensations, breath, so what? Can kind of come up in a phase of doubt in the practice at any time. Or loving kindness. So what's the deal about loving kindness? So you repeat these phrases, you think of the value, you think of this, you know. So what? I'm just bored. I don't think it has any value and so forth. That sort of thing can happen. But, And then that can result, excuse me, parenthetically, that can result in not much faith, not feeling of faith. But if you've been learning this stuff and then some sort of suffering comes up in your experience, either in meditation or in your life, and then you apply one of these techniques, and holy cow, it actually works. And when by works, I mean that you regain some sort of balance, a bit more equanimity, or you just move out of that pit of difficulty and distress. Something shifts due to having taken the action of one of these techniques that you have been somewhat boringly repeating and learning and so forth. Then that experience, the experience of release and freedom from that, maybe it's a small moment of suffering, maybe it's a very big moment of suffering or many moments, then faith really arises. So there does seem to be some kind of connection between experiencing suffering and then faith arising. It's interesting. It gives some sort of motivation. So experiment with that too. Play around with that. Alrighty, so then faith and wisdom need to be balanced. And we can see this when we talk about blind faith. And people, particularly intelligent, reflective people, get so irritated when confronted with people who are caught in some sort of blind faith, where it doesn't seem that they're reflective about it, and not willing to hear anything else, any other input, and so forth. So there's that wanting whoever it is to engage in more wisdom. Cultivating more wisdom. So we've had that experience in relation to other people or reading things and so forth. But then there's another experience of when people have too much wisdom and not enough faith. And what that is you kind of get a little bit pompous, you know, with one's accomplishments. One can hold forth in very wise ways about what one understands, and it can have come from real experience in practice or it can come from a lot of really careful intellectual understanding. That can be particularly frustrating. I remember in one staff room there was a teacher who had actually been a monk for a number of years, so was very, very brilliant in relation to the teachings and how they related to some, to themselves, to everyone, and so on, and could hold forth. But there was something lacking in that wasn't coming out of this person, so that he didn't get the kind of response that he felt he wanted from people, you know, considering his authority and his experience and his practice and so forth. The people in this particular sangha were sophisticated, I thought, enough in the arena of heart and faith to just be able to stand firm and say, well, yeah, you know a lot, but there's something not coming from the heart here. And we want the heart too. There was a certain situation, so that was conveyed. So we know how that is, that there can be a lot of, not just knowledge, but even wisdom, but it can become very, very dry if faith, the juiciness that faith brings in the sense of a deep conviction that runs through the body and is really, I would say, expressed in compassion or in love. That's one of the results. I'm leafing through because looking for that lovely way that Sarah said it, but she didn't. I don't have it. You'll have to accept me saying it. Wisdom, when cultivated very, very deeply, combining with faith to continue on the path even beyond what we might think of as a pinnacle in our own evaluation, starts to take on the flavor of humility. And, you know, it's easy to have humility when you're a beginner. But it gets harder, I think, as progress moves along the path, to maintain that flavor of humility that we see so beautifully expressed in people like the Dalai Lama, for example. Takes that on. And then the more realization, we move into the teachings on emptiness, and then the experience of the emptiness, which Thich Nhat Hanh takes and calls interbeing, to get away from that tendency of interpreting emptiness as voidness. So we get into that flavor of interbeingness, which then kind of blooms with compassion and interconnectedness. And that's then faith and wisdom in balance. And you can feel that being transmitted, or you can feel that absent, even when there's tremendous understanding, without the flavor, the moisture of the faith that is conviction, that is compassion, that is interconnectedness. There's not a balance. And then finally we come to balancing energy with concentration, these two mental factors. And it can be fun in your meditation practice, particularly if you get on intensive retreats, so you've got a long time to develop a lot of energy and a lot of concentration. And you start to notice how, what Joseph mentioned to us, how with a lot of concentration, somehow it can fall into torpor and sleep. It feels very, very weird to start out with a lot of concentration and then suddenly be just falling asleep and nodding off. But I think many of you have experienced it here or at home, where you feel, and there's always this sense of, what am I doing wrong? Because you feel like you were greatly, you know, you're kind of hugging the breath and you're just there wasn't a lot of distraction, you know, you weren't restless and so forth. And then, boom, sleep. And that kind of, the nod, you know. And it just, it's like, how did that happen? And there's just something about the way the energies work, that concentration that isn't energized will slide right off into sleep. So we have to energize it. So again, when we get technique-y, there are techniques to do that. For example, one can intentionally elevate the notion of interest, to become a little bit more interested. But then sometimes the energy of interest can get too strong, and it can go into something that is called fascination. And I hadn't experienced that until one long retreat, 3-month retreat. I just was getting so excited. I was deep into retreat. You know, they say you become secluded from the hindrances. You know, there wasn't a hindrance in sight in terms of the gross form of the hindrances, and I'm just blasting away, you know, not sleeping much, and sitting and walking, and sitting and walking, skipping meals, just, you know, into it, and so forth. And then suddenly it just got wacky, and I came into an interview with Joseph, and I'm telling him all these amazing things I saw, you know, and all of this, the mind-body process, blah, blah, blah. And he said, he said, this happened to me, and Upandita, and there, he gave me the Pali word, which I forget, but it means fascination. Too much energy, even when you're in a very refined state, or possibly especially when you're in a very refined state, just throws everything off, and the concentration, it becomes what they call a kind of a subtle hindrance. The concentration, the excitement, and so forth, you've just taken this big detour. and you're wandering through these subtle experiences of mind and body, but you're no longer proceeding on the main path to freedom from suffering. You're just creating another whirlpool of suffering. I mean, I could see if I had been someone who tended toward writing books, I could imagine the rest of the retreat, I would just be sitting there composing, you know, books about the subtle aspects of the mind-body process in these subtle states and so forth. You know, big distraction. I could write the book, publish it, I'd have to give talks about it, I could write a sequel, I could waste, you know, 20 years being a specialist. It's not proceeding on the path. So even in that refined level of practice, the balance of concentration and energy can get out of whack. And you need to, you know, I was so fortunate to be at that retreat with Joseph in my interview so he could say, this is fascination. And the minute he said it, it's like, boy, it sure is. But luckily for me, you know, a whole 20 years of book writing, you know, I was saved. That wasn't the only time I was saved by an interview with Joseph. He's really good. Just, oh, okay. So that dissolving, getting back into balance. But we can also see it, even when we're not on retreat, in terms of, again, the energy, maybe along with a little bit of bright faith and so forth, we could get very, very distracted. Or we might want to form many committees and build buildings and spend the next, you know, and in a certain way, it's wonderful and it's good Dharma work, but we have to be careful because we can so easily distract ourselves from proceeding on the path with that too much energy. Or in a more ordinary sense, too much energy can be experienced as restlessness. And so then we need to cultivate the ability to concentrate more. In our practice, sometimes it's just seeing it more clearly, just saying, ah, this whole thing is restlessness. So we kind of, encircle it. Restless. And in that way, we've returned to the kind of concentrated awareness that we can have even when things feel chaotic. If we can circle them around and call it restlessness, we're sort of back to center. Or you can see this, of course, those of you who work with small children or have worked with or have had small children or do now, kindergarten and preschool, there's a lot really, whether it's called that or not, of intuitively trying to help little beings cultivate a balance between focus and energy. And because with all that energy, it can just get wild in a kindergarten or preschool class. And teachers know that you got to kind of keep track of it because it's contagious and suddenly the whole thing is just an uproar. So to begin to train little people on how to take their energy and corral it a bit, focus it a bit, so that then there can be something really interesting, exciting, useful that one can do with that energy. And we keep learning that ourselves throughout our lives, our practice lives, and our life in civilian life, balancing the energy that comes up with an ability to focus it. And then on our spiritual path, wisdom helps us make choices about how to focus it. And of course, just even having the ability to see it is because we cultivate mindfulness. So that's the balancing of those two factors of energy and concentration. So then next week will really, as I say, a celebration of the heart of these five, which is mindfulness, the cultivation of mindfulness, the strengthening of mindfulness, the real goal. We are born with a capacity for mindfulness, but it needs development, it needs training, and then it becomes such a power, such a jewel, gold diamond in our path of practice. So a little bit questions, if any from any of these weeks that came up? Yes.
I'm just wondering how you might think about the difference between the fascination that you describe and passion.
Yes, fascination and passion and the difference. Passion can be, we advocate it for art and so forth, a passion for life. But I would say that as people who are training in this particular path, we might develop a more refined view of passion. That we'll have kind of a middle passion, a passion with wisdom, a passion that's focused, and the kind of passion that can get a little bit too fascinated. So what we do as spiritual practitioners is we need to identify our intention. Are we wanting to proceed on a spiritual path? And then do we want what we do in our life to contribute to that? And then the Mahayana traditions too, they very much emphasize the notion that at a certain point you refine your intention, and they call it the bodhisattva path. And in that path, then your goal is service to all beings, and then your focus and your direction would be to develop as much as possible the great passion, which is compassion. And so that becomes a passion for compassion, and that becomes the focus. And then we have the notion and the stories of the great bodhisattvas, the bodhisattva heroes and heroines who are there to tell us that we can develop such a passion for compassion that it benefits beings for countless lifetimes. So that's the great passion. Thanks. Good one. Yes. Actually, I think it's the word for faith in Sanskrit that's related to bhakti.
It also means love.
Exactly. And so that's how we get, again, translation is a little bit odd, because when you translate a word to modern Western and you translate a word that originally has a flavor of love to the word faith, unless you have some sort of background in faith in the West that tells you that, you don't actually feel that connection. But in the original language, it's there. So we have to, we sort of need to remind ourselves that when we say faith, and we also say conviction, but that's a little dry too, that in the original Sanskrit, the word has the same root as the word bhakti, which is love and devotion. So we have to mix those flavors when we're making this faith soup. We have to remember that there's an underlying, you know, like when you have, those of us cooks, when you have an Italian sauce, if it's missing garlic, it's just, you know, it's just not going to do it. Our enchilada sauce without cumin, you know. So we have to know that energy of love and devotion is there, even though it loses something in the translation. Always remembering that with any of these teachings, just a notion that it's possible that the translations into modern English, modern Spanish, modern Australian English, modern British English, different from modern American English, that these things are going to lose things, and so we have to flesh them out a bit. Thanks.
Well, it seems like if you think of faith or oxy in the term in terms of love, that it would apply to all of the faculties. Can you concentrate without a love for what you're doing, or can you really have wisdom without love?
Nice. Exactly. We realize that these five, even though we break them down, separate them to speak of them, are actually like the appendages on the hand. You know, they are separate, but for the best functioning of the whole mechanism, it's going to be working together all the time. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Very good.